Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about vegan diet being the healthiest choice for humans, as well as being the best choice for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Tobias Lienart, author of the book How to Create a Vegan World, A Pragmatic Approach. That's a little later on the show, but first some news. The ongoing global appetite for meat is having a devastating impact on the environment, driven by the production of crop-based feed for animals, a new report from the World Wildlife Fund has warned. The vast scale of growing crops such as soy to feed chickens, pigs, and other animals puts an enormous strain on natural resources, leading to the wide-scale loss of land and species, according to the study from the World Wildlife Fund. Intensive and industrial animal farming also results in less nutritious food, it reveals, highlighting that 6 intensively raised chickens today have the same amount of omega-3 as found in 1 chicken in the 1970s. The study, entitled Appetite for Destruction, was released earlier this month at the 2017 Extinction and Livestock Conference in London, in conjunction with Compassion in World Farming, and warns of the vast amount of land needed to grow the crops used for animal feed, and cites some of the world's most vulnerable areas as the Amazon, the Congo Basin, and the Himalayas. Protein-rich soy is now produced in such huge quantities that the average European consumes approximately 134 pounds of soy each year, largely indirectly by eating animal products such as chicken, pork, salmon, cheese, milk, and eggs. If global demand for meat grows as expected, the report says, soy production would need to increase by nearly 80% by 2050. A staggering 60% of global biodiversity loss is down to the food we eat. We know a lot of people are aware that a meat-based diet has an impact on water and land, as well as causing greenhouse gas emissions, but few know the biggest issue of all comes from the crop-based feed the animals eat.
From One Green Planet, for those aware of animal protection issues, it's well known that cows are exploited and abused in the meat industry and dairy industry. Dairy farms are riddled with horror as female cows are forcibly impregnated only to have their baby calves kidnapped from them at birth, so they can be impregnated again as the calves are kept in tiny hutches to be raised for veal. But Agroplastics, the company who makes these calf hutches, partnered with the National Breast Cancer Foundation and made the hutches pink for their Hutches for Hope campaign. The hypocrisy of using the exploitation of female dairy cows in connection with promoting awareness of female human health is mind-boggling and downright deplorable. In addition, meat and dairy products are linked to a number of serious health conditions, making this campaign even more nonsensical. A petition has been made to call out Agroplastics and make sure they know people are wise to their bizarre masking of the truth of dairy farms. Please take a moment to add your name to the petition at onegreenplanet.org to get Agroplastics to stop this hypocrisy.
Salmon is purported to be one of the healthiest foods due to its high omega-3 content, protein, and essential fatty acids. But if the fish is obtained from Puget Sound in Washington State, it's anything but healthy. According to a recent study, up to 81 drugs and personal care products were detected in the flesh of salmon caught in the Puget Sound. Some of the drugs include Prozac, Advil, Benadryl, Lipitor, and even cocaine. The Seattle Times reports that the levels are believed to be so high because wastewater plants are unable to fully remove the chemicals during treatment. Another theory is that leaky septic tanks are contributing to the problem, as high fecal bacteria counts were also detected. Samples were gathered for 2 days for the study, and salmon and other fish were tested. Chemicals were found not only in the tissue of the fish, but in the water. And the researchers suggest it's likely the study underreports the amount of drugs in the water that are close to outfall pipes or in the deeper waters. According to one study, 97,000 pounds of drugs and chemicals could be entering the Puget Sound each year. As our oceans become increasingly polluted, fish are not a healthy choice. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Tobias Lienart. Tobias is the author of the book How to Create a Vegan World, A Pragmatic Approach. Tobias gives presentations around the world about vegan advocacy and strategy. Most of those presentations are in part of training that he gives together with Dr. Melanie Joy for the Center for Effective Vegan Advocacy. Tobias is also co-founder of ProVeg International, a new pro-vegan food awareness organization that wants to reduce the consumption of animal products worldwide by 50% by 2040. Our conversation with Tobias is next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Tobias Lienart. Thanks for being with us on the show, Tobias.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
Tobias, we'd like to start the show by asking you what inspired you to become vegan.
I went vegan at the time. It started a long time ago when I was thinking about why do I pet my dog and eat cows, and I couldn't find a morally relevant distinction between those two kind of creatures, and I said I have to become a vegan. And I only did that 10 or 12 years later at university, and the reason I postponed such a long time was because I love to eat meat and other animal products. I always was a big meat eater, but then in the end, it finally changed.
Yeah, it seems to be a common occurrence for many people. It's hard to make that adjustment, even though you feel in your heart that something's wrong.
Well, it's becoming easier because there's so many alternatives out there. When I first went vegetarian 40 years ago, hot dogs and hamburgers were vegan, came in cans, and it was like one brand.
So slightly better options now.
Yeah. So
what were you doing in the university that helped, you know, help you learn more and make that connection?
Yeah, I basically met one vegetarian. He was vegetarian at the time, and he gave me a copy of Animal Liberation. And I started reading that, and I got really into it, and I became an activist. And then I wrote my thesis, my master's thesis about, the human-animal relationship. And by the time I finished, I couldn't imagine doing anything else with my life. And then I went to the U.S. for half a year to join some animal rights organizations as an intern. And 6 months later, I came back, and I started an organization here.
And this is in Belgium?
Yeah, Belgium.
Okay, nice. What was that organization?
It still exists. I'm out of it, but it's called the Ethical Vegetarian Alternative. It's a vegan organization. We have 12 paid staff right now, and it's the, as far as I know, the only organization, vegetarian vegan organization in the world that is actually structurally funded by the government. I mean, partly. So we get a substantial amount of government subsidies for the work they're doing.
That's unbelievable. How in the world did you all pull that off?
Well, there was at a certain point, there was a call for organizations that could submit a strategic plan, and the best ones would receive subsidies. And this was with the topic of it was about adult education, was within the Ministry of Culture. And they were looking for all kinds of organizations that did something in the realm of adult education. And our topic was, vegetarian food. And I think one of the reasons why they did that, why they awarded us with subsidies, is that we didn't present it as an animal rights organization, but we presented it as a topic that was good for health, yeah, for the environment, for animals, for all these kind of things. And I think when you talk about health and the environment, governments and also CEOs of companies, et cetera, are much more open to the topic than when you just talk about animal rights.
That's right.
Yeah, people tend to turn off when you say animal rights, but if you actually get to the issues, then it's much harder to to argue with the facts.
You say you went along the path because of Animal Liberation, the book by Peter Singer. That was the first...
Yeah.
That was the first book I read, too, 40 years ago. And most people nowadays, instead of reading a book, they go vegan because of a film or an internet video. What do you think about film and video? Are they too hard-hitting and you know, turn people off?
Well, it's hard to say some things work for some people and don't work for other people. It seems that if you look at research, a lot of people tick the box of, like, when they're being asked, like, what made you go vegetarian or vegan, many people tick the box documentary. So Earthlings or something else. I think it does work for some people, but we shouldn't expect it to work for everybody.
Well, that, you know, most documentaries and films focus on the terrible abuses that animals face in the food industry. Do you think that that's a more effective way of getting to people than talking about the health reasons?
I think we need a combination of these different aspects. And I think especially, like, I mean, these are all arguments. So the animal rights aspect is an argument, and health is an argument, and environment is an argument. But apart from arguments, we can also focus on food and on behavior. And we can give people tasty food, and we can make them change their behavior or partly change it even before they get it, even before they understand the issues of animal rights or health or whatever. If you just make tasty food, or we make sure that tasty food is available, they may taste it just because they like it, because they like the variation or whatever reason. And I think that's a very important part of doing advocacy, actually.
Yeah.
It's hard for people to make the change if they don't realize how good the food can be.
Yeah,
exactly.
And is. But I think that's a good segue to talk about your book, How to Create a Vegan World, a Pragmatic Approach.
So tell us briefly, how do you do that?
Yeah.
What I'm saying in the book is that this is a time to be pragmatic and not too idealistic. It's a time when the whole world is almost dependent on using animals. And in a world like that, a society like that, it's hard to just say, well, this is wrong and we have to stop it. Even if everybody in the world today agreed that it was wrong, we still wouldn't stop. We wouldn't be able to stop the machine. So I think the first thing we need to do is to decrease the dependency on the use of animals. And I suggest a couple of ways to be pragmatic. And the first one is not to just focus on the animal rights arguments, but also on environment, health, and other things. Second one is to not talk about go vegan only, but also to talk to people about reducing. Mm-hmm. Because I think if we have a lot of reducers, that will create a critical mass for change and lead to a vegan world. And I also say that we should focus on the environment in the sense that, like, the environment, the world in which people live, their environment, in the sense that, like, if we can make it easier for them to be compassionate, that's a very important thing. And finally, the most important, the most controversial part is probably the part where I say that the definition of veganism could be a little bit less rigid, maybe, and we don't have to call out people for being just 99% vegan. And if these people want to call themselves vegan, that's fine. So being a little more tolerant and a little bit more, tolerant about a certain grayness around the definition of veganism.
Well, I see it as a spectrum from plant-based to completely vegan, which is awfully hard to do since, you know, animal products are all through our culture, in the asphalt on the streets and our tires on our cars. So. But the definition, as I understand it, is to reduce as much as is possible the suffering of animals. And, you know, within that, there are a lot of people who wear wool and leather but eat a plant-based diet, or people that call themselves vegans but don't really read the labels on household products. There's a whole spectrum.
Yeah,
it seems like we do a lot more harm by trying to critique people for one thing or another instead of focusing on the fact that they're trying to make some changes in their life that are ultimately going to reduce animal suffering. And you know, people don't like to be told they're doing something wrong. And so it seems to be a horribly ineffective strategy, is trying to make someone feel bad if there is one way in which that they can be slightly better living as opposed to, you know, being a positive influence about, you know, maybe this is how I get by without that product, or, you know, this is what I found in the stores that works. And so I definitely agree with that.
And it's also very easy for us to make it look like veganism is a very hard thing to do if we start talking about bone charcoal, filtered sugar.
Right.
You know, we're going pretty hard at it there.
Yeah, it seems that some people want some vegans want people to take the last step first. You know, like they want to go, they want them to go to like to the 100%. And they haven't, I mean, the other people haven't even agreed to do the first 20% yet.
Yeah.
So we have to make sure that people take the first step first, and then the rest will follow. And I have no doubt that, like, if we ever get to a situation where, like, the world is 80 or 90% vegan, the rest will follow automatically. So I'm really not concerned about the tiny details.
Yeah. There's something that in your book that echoed thoughts that I've read by Nick Cooney in his book Change of Heart, which is if you get someone to take a small step, they're more likely to start taking other steps afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's quite logical. It's like if you can show a person that, eating vegan food is edible and is good and is tasty and is convenient and affordable, and they have taken that small step, they will be less defended against change, and they will realize, okay, I can eat like this, and their mind can open up for all these arguments that we're using. Whereas before they were actually realizing that vegan food could be good, they were probably very, it's like the people saying, like, I don't want to watch Earthlings because I know I'll have to go vegan after watching it, which is absurd, but which is true. I mean, these people don't know that they can have good food, and that's why they are wary of listening to the arguments, because they don't want to change. Mm-hmm. So if we show them, look, there is good food to be had, and here's how you do it, and here's where you get it, then the arguments will make a lot more sense, and it will be a lot easier to use them.
And I like one of the things that you highlight too, and going back to your point about reducing and even having people reduce the amount of meat and dairy that they consume, is it actually leads to an increase in products that are available on the market. So that benefits those who are already on that path, and then makes the transition so much easier too for those that are just still making those steps, because there's just the consumer demand is there. And so, you know, the industry is going to want to make money, and so they're going to follow where the demand is.
And that's sort of bothersome in that a lot of the change in the foods that are available is motivated by profit. But, you know, whatever the reason, at least we're getting something other than canned hot dogs.
Yeah, I mean, motivated by profit is like, I mean, it's not our ideal motivation, but I think we have to allow people to do the right thing for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And their reasons may become the right reasons afterwards. The most important thing is, I think, that they take action first, and it can be because of profit, but it leads to change. And we actually, it's lucky for, I mean, profit drives a lot of people. Profit is what motivates them. And we're lucky that today we live in a world, or we've gotten to a stage where looking for these animal product alternatives has become a profitable thing. So that means that in addition to like the environment and animal suffering, etc., profit is one more argument to get into this. And that's really inspiring, or at least hope-inspiring, in the sense that, like, well, there's a lot more people like going to be able to, or going to be willing to put money in this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're seeing, like in Silicon Valley. Is a couple of startups like Beyond Meat and Hampton Creek and things like that, and Impossible Foods. These have together, these handful of companies has acquired more money in just a couple of years' time than the whole animal rights movement combined.
Right.
So that's really significant, of course.
You know, a lot of large corporations are buying up these vegan startups. Recently, Daya Cheese was purchased by, I believe, a Chinese pharmaceutical company. that tests on animals. And a lot of vegans I know started saying, oh, I'm not going to eat dairy anymore. Mm-hmm. That's going a bit far in my mind. I like that cheese.
Yeah. I mean, if the mother company of a company is not ideal, I basically don't care. I mean, it's not that I don't care, but I'm not going to boycott or recommend that we boycott a product for that, because I mean, it's endless if you want to go that far. If you want to say like, look, this company is owned by this company that does this and this and this. I mean, there would be a lot of products you can't have. And also, I mean, if everybody would boycott that, what kind of like signal are we giving? Mm-hmm. I mean, then we're just saying like, well, I mean, we're not hoping that these products will cease to exist, right? So we're just hoping that other people who don't care will buy them, which is a bit hypocritical in a way. So I think we should just make sure that the products that are put on there, and especially by companies with a lot of power to distribute them, I think it's important that they succeed. Just like McDonald's is testing this vegan burger in Finland right now. Uh-huh. It is really important that this is a success. And I can sympathize, of course, with all the people saying like, look, McDonald's killed so much animals and now they want to profit from the alternative as well. Yeah, well, that's a bit frustrating. But I think animals need the help of big business. It's not going to work without it.
That's true. Right. But I'd really rather other customers buy the McVegan. I don't want to support that particular organization.
Right.
One of the things you talk about in the book is how important it is to reach the tipping point for veganism. I wonder if you can expand a little bit upon that and how we can think about achieving that. I know we've touched on that a bit.
Yeah. Well, I think a tipping point, I mean, basically most people see a tipping point in the sense of like a certain number of vegans, like maybe 10, 15, 20. We don't really know. It's this from computer simulations. We don't really know what a tipping point like that would be. I think a faster tipping point that we could achieve would be with a number of reducers, a higher number of reducers. Like there must be a number, if you say like X percent of the people goes X percent vegan. Let's say, for instance, 60% of the people go 70% vegan or something like that. I mean, so there's no vegans among them, but there's like largely vegan, that this could be achieved faster and could have more impact. So that would lead to a tipping point where you get things that are advantages for plant-based products, like in terms of subsidies and pricing and all kind of economic factors of scale, etc., that will make that it will be so that these plant-based products become the default option rather than the way it is now, where the animal products are everywhere the default option. And once that tipping point is reached, I think I have little doubt that we will go further and further till something like a vegan world, also because at that point it will be so much easier to communicate about the moral arguments and so much more easy for people to say like, look, meat eating is wrong. I mean, at the moment when they're not eating all that much meat anymore, it's of course a lot more easy to condemn it. So one thing I write in the book is, it's a quote that says, where you stand depends on where you sit. So if you eat meat, it is very hard to condemn eating meat. But if you eat less of it, your mind opens up for the problems that are entailed in the production of meat. So decreasing the dependency both on an individual level and a societal level is extremely important, I think.
There's, you know, a lot of stereotypes about vegans being angry and preachy. And I've got all my friends are vegan or vegetarian, except one. I've got one non-vegan friend. Mm-hmm. So I'm lucky, but especially in El Paso, Texas. But it's because of the Vegetarian Society of El Paso. But of all the vegans I know and have met at animal conferences, I've seen very few who were angry. They don't fit the stereotype. I have one friend on Facebook that's always ranting and raving, and I'd like to tell her, look, that's not the best approach. You're making people feel guilty, and they're not going to listen to the message.
About the number of, like, I mean, how many vegans would be angry and how many vegans are nice vegans? I have no idea. I mean, what seems to be the case is, first of all, that on social media, there seem sometimes more angry than nice ones.
Yeah.
That may be because they are a lot louder and a lot more present and a lot more active than the nice ones, who sometimes maybe don't comment or like or share. So they could be the nice ones, could be a silent majority that that is less outspoken. In any case, it's important, like, not to confirm the stereotype of the angry vegan, I think, even though they are there. But I think, I mean, to the general audience, I would say that most vegans I know, too, are very nice people who are not just concerned about animals, but who are concerned about all kinds of social justice issues, about people too, and about the environment, etc. So being vegan is generally, it's about an ethic of caring for everything that's sentient and that matters.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's a really beautiful thing to be that. It would be great if all of us could communicate, I think, in a way that is communicate about veganism that is as effective as possible in changing people's hearts and minds. And something I say is that what goes into our mouth, so the food we eat, is less important than what comes out of it. So that the words we speak, because if you look at it, we only have a certain small certain amount of impact with the food that we eat, but we have a potentially much bigger impact with the words we speak in convincing other people or influencing other people to follow our example. If I can influence five people to go vegan, that's five times my own impact. So communicating and advocating is really extremely important, and that's why I wrote the book also, because I think if we can communicate in a good, positive, effective way, we can have a lot more impact than just by being the best vegan or the most pure vegan we can be.
We've been talking with Tobias Lienhardt, author of the book, How to Create a Vegan World, A Pragmatic Approach. Tobias, could you tell us about your website, where our listeners can go to read more of your writings?
Yeah, my website is veganstrategist.org.
Thanks, Tobias. It's been great talking with you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Keep up the great work.
All right, thanks for the interview.
As the leaves start to turn and the air grows chilly, it's clear fall is underway. Most think of the harvest season as a time for apple picking, Halloween costumes, cozy sweaters, and a visit to the local corn maze. But it's also the perfect opportunity to introduce a new family member into your home. As any dog would tell you, the crisp weather is ideal for long walks in the park during the day and snuggling on the couch at night. Yet so many pups are still without homes when autumn rolls around, an estimated 3.3 million. October is Adopt a Shelter Dog Month and a great time to find the dog of your dreams through online databases such as AdoptAPet.com and PetFinder and at local adoption events. And if you're not pet ready yet, that's okay too. You can make a difference this month by donating money, time, or supplies to your local animal shelter or posting a picture of the homeless dogs in your area using the hashtag FindYourFido to raise awareness. For those wary of long-term commitment, fostering a dog is a great way to get an animal out of a shelter and into a home, even if it's just for a few nights. This fall, you too can save a life and do loads of good for canine friends everywhere.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org and click on the Calendar of Events link, which will let you know the many events that we have planned for the next few months.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Greg Lawson. For the Earth, the animals, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.